session number 10429, rule 6.
Captain Batchelor, Reel 6. You were saying that at least two gunny sacks were needed.
Yes, because of the simple reason that the we found by experiment that the ending is burst. Of course, it's amazing to see what the Hercules transport aircraft do today in dropping foodstuff. They have these things about the size of a room in nylon. I suppose it's nylon, great packages and things, which of course will take anything and bounce all over the ground. But we were limited in the amount we could carry in the bomb bays, and of course this problem was safe. Nevertheless, the fact remains that the Dutch have ever afterwards commemorated this occasion, and we've got a special display in the Bomber Hall, and they have had many receptions in Holland. Aptly named Operation Manor. I went on it a couple of times, and one thing I recall, even in the flooded areas, people on the rooftops with enormous banners and national flags and everything else waving, tremendous scene of enthusiasm. And I think, as they say, the Dutch have ever been grateful.
Whereabouts did you actually fly to in the Netherlands?
I can't remember, but it's all recorded with particular zones, and quite a lot of aircraft, and offhand I don't know, it's all recorded, the tonnage and everything else, but it did save, because it was a long time before Dutch were returned to adequate wartime sort of feeding. I think looking back on these times, all the criticisms. Now, I'm chairman of the Bomber Command Association, and we meet periodically and have a reunion, and I have a Mildenhall reunion, which is we seat 400 at a time. There's more we can take, and there are 1,400 members, and people come from Canada and Australia and New Zealand, not to necessarily to reminisce, sometimes to bring their wives over to show them where the stamping ground is. In other words, I found with the Bomber Command Association, there is a tremendous enthusiasm, a resurgence of human enthusiasm over all these years, from nostalgia, of course, and reminiscing. But also, we've been at particularly pains to right the wrongs. There's been a dreadful film called Fireraiser, which was generated by a left-wing organisation in anti-war in Brighton, run by girls. And Max Waugh was the portraying bomber command, boss of Bomber House. Travesty of the truth, blasphemous. And the worst thing about it has Channel 4 dropped it, fortunately, on grounds of editorial comment, and we slated it right, left and centre. But it has been told abroad and that sort of thing, and these know-alls who know all about the war and what went wrong and who was right and who was wrong, they really ought to be pilloried, because these things do so much harm to up-and-coming generation.
Can you pinpoint some specific criticisms that you have of the arguments that were put forward in that film?
Well, I mean, one of them, as you know, one of the things is, you know, that everybody hears and reads so much about Dresden. One thing that, before he died, old Bomber Hash used to appear annually at the Bomber Command Association dinner. And he was always careful not to repeat himself from previous meetings, and he quoted chapter and verse. The first time I heard it, 10 years or more ago, I said I waited 35 years to hear this straight from the horse's mouth. Complete vindication of Bomber Command, because he said so many things which had either been glossed over or lost and so on. And as he had had the opportunity of in-depth discussions with Albert Speer, who was Hitler's armament king, and amongst other things, Dresden's always taken out of context. But you know, on the raid on Hamburg, which we at Mirrenhold took part, or raid on Hamburg, there was a phenomena in the sense that the number of incendies were dropped, which was designed to burn the city out, not to blast it out, was created a firestorm with a tremendous vortex, and it was in effect, the casualties were rather like Hiroshima, quite unexpected, quite unpredicted, and this caused 10,000 of casualties. But Speer said to Bomber Harris, if you'd done to six German cities what you did to Hamburg, Germany would have collapsed. Now that was straight from Albert Speer. Amongst other things, Bomber Harris said, Bomber Command had been accused of only having sunk one new boat during the war. And from Albert Speer had said 400 had not got to sea because of the efforts of Bomber Command. What happened was that because of the constant bombing of shipbuilding yards like Wilhelmshaven and Kiel and so on, the Germans were reduced to prefabricating new boats in other areas, and because the sections were too big to trade by road or by road, they were used the Dortmund-Ems Canal, which is one of the reasons why we periodically drain the Dortmund-Ems Canal. And so on and so on. These are all little, his answers to the devastation caused to the German coastwise shipping by our mining was quite incredible. And yet, here was a man who was carrying out the strategy of the war cabinet. And people blame him as though he was an individualist who had taken upon himself to wage a war as he thought fit. But the point really is that they take Dresden because, for some unknown reason, it's taken as, by the left wingers and the public at large that Dresden was a criminal offence, in that it was an innocent, art-loving metropolis, which really was on the outskirts of any warlike operations or such sort, and had been bombed out of existence by Bomber Command as a malicious effort against a hitherto untouched city. And people take in, start counting all the military targets which weren't, to their mind specifically, destroyed or attacked. But everybody forgot it was a forward communication centre for the Russians' front, and a focal point, therefore, for all sorts of 101 things. And in any, as you, everybody knows, in Coventry attacks, which is only an isolated case out of hundreds we did on Germany, the disruption of the normal communications and services, foodstuffs, supplies, water and gas and whatever, is a major disruption in the economy of any given city, particularly industrial cities, and all those who support the industries. The only difference is that in the Ruhr, for instance, the Germans had with the available slave labour force to make very quick repairs by putting slave labourers hard to work. This is one of the things we had to combat. But Dresden was taken completely out of context, and as it was a horrific stain on our honour, and was malicious. Now, in this particular film, apart from virtually portraying with this comedian ex, Max Wall, who was a very forceful character on the thing, not trying to be comic as I thought he might have been, portraying Bomber Harris, I'll just mention one phase, and that they had Bomber Harris dressed in mess kit, which he wouldn't have worn. That's full mess dress, medals and all, because he wouldn't have worn it after the war. He went off to left the country after the war temporarily. And wining and dining with a groaning table laden with everything under the sun, and he portrayed the marking, well, the marker force of the Dresden by pouring port into Stilton cheese, and then sipping a brandy in a brandy glass. He arranged other glasses to show the disposition of the German and Soviet forces in relation to Dresden, and the squadrons were lines of cigars. I mean, it really was a quite tasteless, unforgettable, horrendous portrayal, and knowing the man, he was a forthright character. Of course he was, and a very determined man. His only great plea was, of course, to double the size of Bomber Command, because had we had enough, we never had enough to do everything. There's no doubt about it in my mind, for having been in Bomber Command for 6 years, that had we had, particularly from the middle of the war on, the forces which we and the Americans wanted, we would have put Germany out of action without any question. The force of the use of that sort of weapon is brought to a head, of course, by the example of Hiroshima, which, of course, virtually ended the war in one stroke. To my mind, probably Nagasaki wasn't necessary, but Hiroshima, which did virtually little more than we did on Hamburg, brought the war and saved probably another 500,000 Allied lives fighting every inch of Japan. But the Germans were an extremely tough, resilient race, aided, of course, by hundreds of millions of slave labour, plus the ability to... they moved their aircraft factories further and further east, virtually out of our reach. But they were, after all, defeated by the kind of efforts of the Allies. There are those who still now think in terms of Bomber Command's efforts at disasters, but one thing I hope we repaired only recently, to a certain extent. Bomber House, known to us all, effectively as Bomber House, was Sir Arthur, Master Royal Air Sir Arthur House, was the only commander who, in chief, who didn't get a peerage. Now, the post-war Attlee government disassociated themselves from the bomber offensive, and one of the causes of the trouble was the subsequently Air Minister, one John Strachey. John Strachey had been a communist before the war and a cohort of Blunt & Co. He then, being obviously an opportunist, joined Moses Blackshirts. He then became, I think somewhere in the war, liberal, and then finally a socialist. I think as a squadron leader, I can't remember, when people can pick me up on the details, but he was on Bomber Command's Harris, Bomber Command staff as a squadron leader, and Bomber Harris tried to get rid of him because of his record. Anyway, he, as much as anything, was the cause of Bomber Command and Bomber Harris not getting his peerage. In other words, a vindictive air ministry got his last say. Now, that was, Bomber House wasn't all that worried, but what he was always worried about is the lack of recognition from his boys, as he called us, the old lags in Bomber Command. That was a slur on the whole command, a grievous slur which we all felt. Remember, there were tens of thousands in Bomber Command, the biggest of all the commands, who felt it very strongly. I won't go into all the arguments over a Bomber Command medal or anything for and against, but certainly to his heart, Bomber has felt very upset at this slight slur on the command.
One book I've just been reading is by David Irving, called
Yes.
War Among the Generals.
Yes.
War Between the Generals.
Yes.
In which he claims that everybody in Bomber Command during the war used to call Sir Arthur Harris Butcher Harris because of the casualties not only that he caused in Germany, but that the casualties he caused to Bomber Command aircrew themselves. Is that true?
I'm very pleased you raised that point, because one thing he hated was being called Butch. I wouldn't refer to him as Butch Harris. It was one of these sort of catchphrases and things, but nobody ever... after all, I was in an operational command in squadrons and operational stations. I never heard single criticism of what was grievous slaughter at times, and we had heavy losses, but never heard anybody... I mean, somebody asked me the other day, for instance, on Chamberlain. Even I had a Czech squadron. Never heard anybody in that Czech squadron levy criticism at Chamberlain or at our letdown. Even more, I ever heard it from the Poles. And I think this was a term that was... there are a lot of relatively... if you like, uneducated in the ways of the world, members of Bomber Command, as anywhere in all walks of life, and those are banded around these catchphrases. Butch was a term which was used irreverently, but I know for a fact that Bomber Harris hated it. Bert was more like it, Bert Harris, as the cat said. But Butch, I don't think it was even coined during the war. Certainly, to my certainty, he never coined in return to heavy losses. Never. Because after all, he didn't command Bomber Command until, 42 or something or other. And then our losses had started to go down. And they were relatively, there were odd incidents where, of course, the losses were high. But, the reasons were often predictable. But never in my certain knowledge, Augsburg, no big raids like that, Nuremberg, and what have you, I can never hear any. It may have been sort of banded around here and there, but I think we all felt that we were serving a cause, a just cause, and that we had to bloody well win and knock the Germans out and to do everything we could to do it. That's why, as I said earlier on, I'm a great believer in Chamberlain giving us a year's grace. And post-war, what I was going to say is finally is on this aspect of Bomber Command. Last year we wrote to the Queen Mother and asked if she could come to dinner. She had another engagement, and I threw in for good measure, would she consider being our patron, since she had opened the Bomber Command Museum with Bomber Harris, which was royal recognition, if ever was. Would she become a patron? This was she'd opened the museum in 83, the year before Bomber Harris died. He outlived all the other commanders. And would she become our patron? And she agreed. Now, that was an accolade which, to my mind and to those members of the association, they repaired a lot of the damage which we've all suffered under, in a sense, because they are the uninformed, the ill-informed, who, and after all, as you know better than I do, the books galore written. You can rewrite history any time you like and point out what should have been done and shouldn't have been done. But agreed that Bomber Command in its early stages, after all, we had some grievous mistakes right at the beginning when we lost on these abortive daylight lays. We lost the cream of Bomber Command on my own squadron before I got there on these daylight raids on the theory that the mass bomber formation with all its guns could ward off any fighters, and of course didn't, plus the fact they didn't have self-sealing tanks and so on, and they were shot out of the sky. And quickly we learnt that we could only use the cover of darkness effectively. The Americans went through the same losses until they had big fighter escorts. The advent, why no one had ever thought of it before, the long-range tank, the drop tanks for fighters, God knows, but that was the answer to fighter escorts, from which we ourselves were, of course, grateful for, because we had Fireshawe Scots in our daylight rides, whereas before, earlier on, the Spitfire could hardly get across the channel. These are things which, in retrospect, it's far easier to say, why the hell did we go for 3 four-engine bombers instead of one, as with the V-bombers we had for 3 V-bombers before we got one which was successful, and so on. But often industry, the theories behind aviation in particular, like Barnes Morris, are far in advance of the technology to be able to cope with these theories. I mean, old Barnes Morris was invented the swing wing, which is now common in Tornado and what have you, and will eventually be in airliners and so on. And all these advanced theories and things, the First World War, the reason why we didn't get the performance was the inability, quite understandably, of technological development to produce engines of sufficient power, and so on. So there was stick and string mine. But the progress of aviation over the whole time, of course, has advanced as technology advances. So as simple as that.
Could I ask you about this dispute with Ralph Cochrane and Five Group forming his own Pathfinder force in Five Group?
Yes.
Were you aware at the time that there was this kind of conflict between Cochrane and Bennett?
Well, I think that one of the things I can remember about Cochrane as an illustration, he came to Three Group headquarters from to take over the group. He'd been director of flying training and the Air Ministry is now Commodore, operated the Air Various Model, and he came with a whole lot of preconceived ideas on how to win the war. And my boss, who was died recently, and was Air Marshal Gray, a great character, was the senior air staff officer. And when we'd done all the morning's plan, we used to go in to the AOC to lay before him what all the plans were and the weather and what have you for the night's operations. And I all remember having to retire discreetly because an argument started in which the worthy Sasser was trying to get the AOC to appreciate one or two points for which he was either being too dogmatic about or not properly briefed. It was a difficult period. So in other words, Cochrane was also distinguished himself by being had no sense of humour. And one of the reasons why, though he was vice chief of the air staff, I always think he could never have been chief of the air staff because he would not have got on with the other services commanders. And I think this was probably dogmatism. And the man you want to ask is Hamish Mahaddy, because I always say that Hamish Mahaddy was the only man who could talk between the two groups. He used to go poaching into Five Group to get Pathfinder crews, but he was GTI in Pathfinders when he had been serving in Three Group as well. I don't think it only extended, probably not necessarily to any personal arguments, but to tactical reasons. And as I say, Cheshire did a remarkable work as a Pathfinder. In other words, the Five Group, I think they must have used them on, had to use them on some operations, but they were rather sort of independent. But as you know, there were lots of personality obvious clashes from strong will, like the Dowding and one in Fighter Command with another man with a sense of humour who doesn't matter.
Lee Mallory.
Yeah, Lee Mallory. He was SASO when I was in Iraq. Another man to avoid all sense of humour. Often appointed a man's character, funny enough, I think, you know, on the ability to get on with other people's.
Could I just ask you finally to, if you could say something about the Indian independence in 1947 and what you personally did then?
That's interesting. You're going to be onto a raw subject. I stayed on in Mildenhall. We were bringing back, once the war collapsed, I had 617 Squadron join me there because they were being reshuffled to send with 9 Squadron a token force, which the commander preferred to call Tiger Force, to Okinawa to support the Americans against Japan when Hiroshima put pay to that. So I had the 617 squadrons with their gutted aircraft to carry the 22,000 pounder and the mines and so on down with me then. And so when the war collapsed, I put the 3 squadrons on to. We were bringing back ex-prisoners from France and Germany back to England, ex-British prisoners. And I must digress on one thing on that. I brought back one chap, I think it was from Juvenile Corps, who'd been our oldest RAF prisoner. Can't remember his name now. Palmer or something like that. Anyway, he'd been shot down the first week in September. He was worried about being accepted as a normal being. But I should have sent him on straight to a sort of interrogation centre, but I kept him in the house and we had a party and so on, and he thoroughly enjoyed himself and I gave him a shirt or something or other. But one thing I always remember, he was shot down, of course, before Christmas 39. And he was summoned to see Goering. And at that time, Goering had sort of from his First World War affinity to fighter pilots and so on, was sending crates of tomatoes and things to a few British prisoners of war. And this chap was taken to Berlin, and Goering wasn't there, and he was taken out to where Goering was in Potsdam. And Goering had a long discussion with him and said, "You've got nothing to worry about, you'll be home before Christmas. England's got nothing more to go on fighting about." That presumably must have been the German philosophy at the time, that, you know, it was we were headed to go on scrapping. That was just one thing, but the odd things. I say, we then went off to Italy, bringing back prisoners of war from there. And at the end of 45, I decided I ought to really get out of command because broaden my horizons. And I was posted to senior air staff officer of one Indian group in Peshawar on the northwest frontier, legendary place. And the object of the exercise was where we were training the all Indian air forces in one. In flying training all the way.